Yeah, so that gives us an overview of the entire story, and the really perplexing part of it is the fact that they're willing to pay 1 million rand to settle so that she doesn't go to court. Now, we are scheduled to speak to Chris Vick about this. Two well-known spin doctors have weighed in the ANC so-called 50 million war room that was set up to influence last year's local government elections. When news of COVID campaign, which focused on enhancing the ANC's presence on social media and disempowering its political rivals by printing fake election posters, are engaging social media influencers, media strategists and journalists. Chris Vick tweeted, "This is just the tip of the iceberg. This is just the tip of the iceberg." That is what Chris Vick had to say about it. So we're going to be chatting to him to try and get insight on what is it that is still to be unveiled, what is further being hidden here. And as soon as we're able to get hold of him, we'll continue chatting about the War Room 1. What are your thoughts? The ANC now denying this. Are we going to see some sort of irregularities coming forth? Are we going to see all the information being poured forth, coming out on this particular story? So we wait and see, and will it get to the courts, or will it be settled before that? Yesterday we spoke to Mabene Siyebe, who is from the DA, and he's the spokesperson for the national leader of the DA. We now do have Chris Vick on the line. Chris, good afternoon to you, and welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for chatting to us, availing yourself. We mentioned to the listeners just a few moments ago your tweet that this is just the tip of the iceberg. Were you approached to participate in the so-called war room?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, at the time, I didn't pay much attention to it. I was approached by somebody who sent me a WhatsApp message saying that they'd been referred to me by Shaka Sisulu, and they wanted to know if I would be what they called a promoter for a Twitter campaign. I asked what that meant, and they said it would mean being part of a team that got paid to tweet particular items around the ANC election campaign and to retweet other people whose names would be given to me. I was then asked to attend a meeting where I would share my ideas about how it would work, which I found a bit strange, and I said, but if this is your idea, not mine, surely you should be telling me what you want. And then that's where the conversation ended. So I don't even remember the name of the person, but I mean, they were very obviously working as part of this project, and their objective was to try and get people to assist them in getting social media coverage of particular issues related to the ANC election campaign.
So why did you not attend the meeting? Why did you decline the invitation?
Well, it felt very amateurish, to be honest. I mean, I just a random sort of WhatsApp message from somebody, firstly, I thought was a bit strange. Secondly, the fact that they were asking me to give them my ideas, whereas they'd approached me about being part of their team. I don't work like that. I mean, it just didn't feel like the right thing to do, and that's why I didn't pursue it anymore.
You believe it's just the tip of the iceberg? What do you mean when you make those statements?
Well, I think what's come out in the court case and what's probably going to come out in other discussions is that this unit, although it might have had good intentions, wasn't linked to the ANC election campaign. It's very clear that they looked at external funding for what they were doing. And I think what the next set of questions should be are, where did that money come from? What was the expectation of people who were funding it? Did they think they were funding an ANC election campaign or a sort of rogue unit, as Letsuli House has described it? And I think that's the one issue, where the money came from and how it was spent. And then secondly, what's the role of people in Letsuli House, such as Ignatius Jacobs, who've been named? What was their role? Why were they trying to get extra payments for themselves, according to one of the court documents, for this thing? You know, I mean, it's very, very murky. I must say, the concept of war rooms is not unique. I mean, I think all political parties do it. But to have it run outside the formal structures of the ANC raises questions, and the fact that the money was being raised separately through approaches to business people also raises a whole lot of questions. And I think those are the sorts of details that we should be paying attention to now.
Yes, now, you know, you spoke about the fact that it was being run separately outside the structures of the ANC. So does it then fall into electioneering or not?
Well, I think that's another issue that needs to be explored. I mean, the IEC has very strict regulations around political party conduct and how they run their campaigns. And it seems like at least one of the posters that was produced by this unit was in violation of the election agreement. And I think that's why, you know, there are more questions here that need to be answered. Let me just leave it at that.
You believe it would it have worked at any point, or was it doomed from the beginning?
Well, if I go on the interaction that I had, as I say, it was pretty amateurish. If I look at the names of the people, you know, that have been published on social media, I don't think they're specialists in political messaging. They might be specialists in how to use social media for mass mobilization. They might be specialists in how to run events and hospitality lounges and that sort of thing. But political messaging is a specific science. And, you know, the ANC has its own election unit which develops those messages and trains ANC people voluntarily in how to get that messaging across. And I think that is the tried and tested way to do it. But I think one of the realities that the ANC is facing, and probably other political parties, is social media is a completely different dynamic to conventional electioneering. If you look at the way Trump used it in the U.S., you look at the way Barack Obama used it for his election campaign, people are looking at how you use this tool, the fact that you've got access to so many people, and it's unfiltered. You know, I can do an interview with you. You can ask the questions you want. You can cut answers that you don't like if you want to do that. Social media is completely unfiltered, and it's a very powerful platform in terms of the Arab Spring, in terms of other initiatives that have taken place across the world. So it poses real challenges, because conventional election campaigners and conventional PR and media people don't necessarily know how to use this medium properly. And it does bring about a whole lot of challenges with it, because we have fake news, we have paid Twitter, we have fake Twitter accounts. You know, I mean, I've seen that around the Gupta family, for example. There are Twitter accounts with 1 or 2 or 300 followers who just retweet and recycle the same information. It's completely unmitigated, which makes it powerful, but also makes it quite dangerous if it's not managed properly.
Yes, interesting. Uncharted territory, undoubtedly. Chris, we appreciate your time this afternoon on Radio Islam.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest in the issue. It's a very important one for our democracy.
Thank you for availing yourself to chat on it.
Great. Bye-bye.
This is Chris Vick chatting to us this afternoon about the entire war room story, an interesting one, and greater insight being shared now on how these things work, and the fact that in other countries, political parties also do set up war rooms, and how it works, or the advent or the coming about of social media and the impact that it does have on electioneering.